Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to Deep Thoughts. Today, as you can see, we're going to talk about Flat Earth one more time, at a minimum. Now, if you watch my shows, you know that I talk about Flat Earth all the time, in between anything that's minor reference to how the universe is put together and stuff. I wanted to share with you how that theory came to me, sort of my feelings when I did my first episode on it, where I really gave it a fair analysis, which is way back in season one. I don't want to try to reference the actual episode number, but somewhere in the mid 40s or 50s of season one. I want to talk about, you know, where I've been since I made that episode. I also made an episode called The Firmament, which did really well. And sort of my feelings now about it. I have a episode coming out, which I don't know what order I'm going to do these in, but I have one that's about the electrical universe that will be coming out, where I kind of take my position of where I am now. So I'm going to repeat that intro because we're on the subject now. I have friends of mine who have shows, and they have pounded this and absolutely pounded this. And then I have my smoke lounge. I have one of the coolest smoke lounges here in Huntington Beach, and we vacillate between probably three different things that we watch when we're smoking. And if you have never been to a smoke lounge, it's where we smoke cigars. There's a hookah place downstairs, but you usually have a television, and you're smoking and talking. Some smoke lounges focus on sports. Ours is really cool. It focuses on YouTube, Netflix, and movies that we all bring in, you know, CDs and DVDs and all that kind of stuff, Blu-rays. I shouldn't say CDs, but so the conversation is always continuing and evolving, but the Flat Earth thing has definitely fallen off quite a bit, although we just revisited it a little bit. And what's very, very interesting about it is that I can say that I've got at least probably four friends that definitely believe now that the world is a flat disc. And for those of you, I doubt you would bump into this episode as a first pass on Flat Earth. I would suggest you don't, but just in case you do, the theory is fairly simple. When you hear about Flat Earth, you, depending on your age, you will think about the album covers to Kansas, the rock band, where it's kind of like a square, and that the Earth is on a square plane, and that the oceans somehow fall off the edge of this plane and somehow replenish. That is not the theory of Flat Earth. The theory of Flat Earth, which goes back probably in a believable cultural form 500 years ago, it was the way that we believed the world to exist. And then it went back thousands of years in multiple religions, and it is always presented as a round disc. And the disc itself has been portrayed as having curvature to it in some cases it's flat. But the disc is holding the oceans in by using the ice shield, which is referred to as the Antarctica. On the heliocentric globe model, you have the continent at the bottom, which is about 11 to 12,000 mile around continent. It's very jagged and in its shape, but it's overall circular. But in the Flat Earth model, it is a border around the outside of a disc that is essentially the UN logo and a lot of logos. Now, people say, you know, wow, the big conspiracy is that the UN uses a logo that is the Flat Earth. It's all hidden in plain sight. That there's 33... little, you know, map compartments and longitudinal, latitudinal designations, and therefore it's a Masonic thing, 33. And so they can immediately draw a lot of conclusions and connections to that may or may not be true, right? Now, on my Electrical Universe episode, I outline the fact that expanding Earth is the number one reason why I believe the world is still round. And then we get like Neil deGrasse Tyson coming out and saying it's an oblate sphere, which I don't know. He didn't make any distinction that it's oblate, yet it is still circular to the mind from space. Then he said it was pear-shaped, which a lot of us thought was a cover for the fact that the southern hemisphere would be much larger around than the northern hemisphere because it'd be the outer reaches of the disk, right? Now, the beautiful thing I have at my disposal is that the gentleman that runs my smoke lounge, obviously he's there all day long and he spends a fair amount of hours by himself watching this content. And so I can ask him, you know, what is the, and he believes it's flat, by the way. He's a very well-educated person, very, very smart individual on everything else in life. So for him to say he thinks it's flat was very fascinating to me because he's not dumb. And so I ask him all the time, I say, well, how is the flat earth movement going? Because I haven't really visited it online in any capacity for, geez, 6 to 8 months or so, right? At least. And he's telling me, you know, look, there are videos coming out every single day. And again, my friends that I know that do these, Jed Skeptic being one of them, he's doing stuff constantly. So the interest is there. And, you know, some folks went in believing it or giving it a really good chance. I definitely was one of those people. And they have pulled out of it. They no longer think it is flat, and they think it's a psyop, and which is a psychological operation to create sort of some fodder for your mind and for the time of your day that you would be researching other things. And again, there's this paper written in 2008 called the Cognitive Disinformation paper, which has been submitted as being written in 2008, and it talks about the fact that the government made a decision to create campaigns that would distract humanity. And really cause the human mind to doubt reality at every turn, such that we become so disoriented we really can't get a grasp of reality, which makes us docile to those people who would know what reality really was, you know? And so, you know, I've had various comments in the comment section forever saying, man, you got to do another one on flat earth. You got to do another flat earth. Now, the thing is, the reason for doing another episode in support of Flat Earth would be to submit new evidence that's been discovered since the initial push, which I think there's not enough new evidence that I've seen personally to fill up an hour's worth of discussion. I'm wondering if this will get much past an hour in itself, right? The interesting thing, because after looking at it for a while, and again, I want to precursor this with the notion that some people feel really nervous talking about things like flat earth because it seems so silly. Of course, we know it's round. Everyone has agreed it's round for 450 years or so. So how dare we question the research by people that have been celebrated for their intelligences for those 400 plus years, who have concluded that it's round, who have believed they've proven it's round, and that kind of stuff. And there's a fair point there, right? So we feel sort of defensive about putting our foot down one way or the other. And I will say that I toyed for weeks, if not months, probably months, saying to myself, okay, let's do this. Let's go out every day and just think that the world is flat and it adheres to this disc model. And just see how the world feels. You know, on a day-to-day basis, let's look up at the sky and believe it's a firmament dome. And let's look at the clouds and let's feel gravity and feel the lack of, you know, spin on the surface of the world. And just see if anything pans out. See if anything extra pans out in the observational collection of data in being alive, right? And I had a couple funny moments. And it's just a game I played with myself. And I couldn't play it for a whole day. I would play it for maybe, honestly, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, because then my brain starts kind of coming back to my upbringing, which is definitely heliocentric. But there was a couple times that I had beautiful sunny days here in California last summer, and I remember walking and thinking, wow, what if that was a dome? And for a moment, my mind said, it is a dome, it is a dome. And I was just looking at it and feeling what that felt like. And there is an interesting euphoria that you can have and manifest in yourself if you can convince yourself of that for even a split second. It's very interesting. For me personally, the feeling of comfort comes from the more religious interpretations of this assertion, which is that we are extremely close to our Creator. Now, most people in the Flat Earth community that want to go down that line, they talk about it being God. God creates the firmament, and then we live in it, which means He's right there. And there's definitely a wonderful feeling about that. Now, there's a lot of us that feel close to God regardless, you know. But there's this extra feeling, this almost exponential feeling of bliss when you do believe for a split second that that is the case, that aliens didn't create the dome, that God did. And I always like to remind you that if human beings could create a dome and put beings in it, we would. We simply would. And if we had to suspend it with cantilevers and gigantic whatevers to make it seem flat on another round, beautiful planet, we would. We would even probably dig it into the ground to make sure it's a flat surface, and that way our moon, being way too big for Earth, would make sense, because it's not way too big for Earth. What we're really on is something much larger, and this is just some agrodome of some sort. However, the stars, I think, sort of level the playing field on that, if the firmament dome were not some brilliant projection system. But I even think that is almost a physical impossibility. So what's occurred in my smoke shop is that for probably the last month or so, we've revisited some of the videos that claimed it was flat, and we've watched some, well, you know, again, on YouTube, you can say it's a new video to you, but it'll have a, you know, published 2 years ago date. And there's always something kind of disappointing about that you're learning something that you wish you'd known 2 years ago, but you're learning it today. But whatever, you get to see the video. But I watched for the very first time a gigantic chain of videos made by different people. Some people made like five in a row. But I was up there and I watched a bunch of the Flat Earth debunking stuff. And the first debunking ones that came out were sort of silly. They were had a lot less examples and facts. They just essentially called everyone names for believing that it was flat, which is understandable because they're having a reaction to it. And so it was easy to dismiss any criticism, right? But there were a few just recently that I think really pretty much brought me back to my own beliefs. Well, I should say, I mean, everyone, I think, grows up with round Earth as the base belief system, right? You're raised with globes in your libraries, in your schools. It's in every space show on TV. It's globe, it's globe, it's globe. So we all start off with that comfort zone being in the heliocentric model. Now, as you've heard me say several times on the show, that I don't believe that there's any reason to be really upset, slash the new term is butthurt, because you believe it's round and you think, you know, people are crazy, believe it's flat, or you think it's flat and you think people are nuts, think it's round. The truth that we always must remember is that unless you're an astronaut, and unless astronauts are real, almost every human being on Earth, minus a few dozen people, have never been into space to observe it with your own eyes. And the only real travelers that would have the ball Earth perfectly defined for them are folks that have traveled to the moon and back. Whether or not they stepped on the moon or not is irrelevant. They would have gone away from Earth far enough that the Earth would be small and round, and or big and round, and they would be able to say, wow, I have seen the Earth from space and I know that it's round. Now you might think, well, what about the space station people? Well, it's definitely a way to see curvature, for sure. You'd have to be in the space station. The shuttle people would have been high enough to see curvature. But the amount of curvature is always distorted in NASA's photographs, and they would admit so because they want to see as much of Earth in a photograph as possible, and so they typically put it in a fisheye lens, which gains, you know, tremendous distortion, which you would not see from the minimum height or the maximum height that they achieve, right? And if you ever want to do the math really quickly on the percentage of how far off the surface of the planet these folks get, you take the any vehicle, you just look it up on Wikipedia, the vehicle's altitude, be it the space station or a particular shuttle mission, they're all up there, and you take the miles up, and you divide it by 8,000. Just round up the diameter of Earth, which is about 7,900 miles, and divide it by 8,000, and then move the decimal place 2 points to the right, and you will get the percentage of how far they are off the surface of the planet. And so that can be factored into how much of the curvature you would see from a round ball, right? So the you know, if you want to believe it's round, but you're still willing to be skeptical to a degree, the most disheartening scientific evidence from the scientific community that makes it sort of, it makes you sort of say, come on, guys, come on. Is all of this, you know, obviously on this show, I believe through being, and I forgot to mention this in my Moon Hoax Part 2, but I was debriefed by two NASA scientists about not going to the moon. And these were very celebrated people. Both of them had spent a couple of years on the Mars Project. Both of them resigned as a result of finding out that we hadn't gone to the moon and that we weren't going to be going to Mars anytime soon in their lifetime. But they were offered big fat paychecks and pretty much given the full debriefing on the fact that we didn't go. So that for me is the sort of coup de grace for it being a theory versus it being a reality. Now again, they told me a lot of the reasons why we couldn't go, which match a lot of the reasons that we understand today, but they didn't have the whole thing worked out. They didn't have how the hoax was perpetrated and all that stuff. So they had enough. They had enough to leave, which is utterly phenomenal because one of the guys was a celebrated prodigy. He had worked for NASA since the age of 16, had several patents within NASA for being really brilliant, and he contributed to satellite technology. So, you know, again, people who think satellites don't exist, well, my buddy has patents for contributing to designs of various aspects of satellites and it's aspects of satellite technology that you're aware of. I'll just leave it at that. You know, I'm always trying to kind of shroud his identity because I don't have any permission to do so. And I respect that. So, but the real letdown is the fact that I do not believe, unfortunately, even though I believe that satellites exist in some form or fashion, I do not believe we have a credible shot of Earth from space. I've talked about this many times, so I'm not going to spend much time on it, but you know, the real crux of the situation is twofold. All the pictures of Earth from space don't match each other. The continents have horrible proportions. You know, one of the shots that was submitted had North America consuming the probably 2/3 of the surface of Earth, which would not have left enough space for all the other continents to exist. And these are submitted by space institutions that you respect, right? The other ones are the color patterns are really bad. We've identified proof that they've taken Photoshop and they've cut and pasted the storm systems over and over and over again, which is a technical impossibility, a physical impossibility of the universe. And the thing I always mention, which is the Peter projection map, which is the current understanding as of the mid-50s, 20th century, understanding of the true proportions of the continents, which are pretty much the exact, you know, shape of the continents, but they're longer, they're taller on the Earth's surface. And there was a big campaign in the mid-50s of the 20th century to replace the globes around the world and get it right. And they were ceremoniously rejected. And so it remains wrong. And when Google Earth matches the globe in your library, it's wrong. When the blue marble shot from Apollo 17 can't match Google Earth, then you know it's wrong. And it's not matching it the Peter projection map. It's actually even more foreshortened from its original form. And again, that shot had the Black Sea all messed up and was later corrected. So the bummer is that if you believe it's round, you're really standing on the shoulder of individuals that have concluded this through minor observations. and you don't have the proof. You might have proof in star algorithms more than anything. And the stars are truly the part that really wraps my mind back to it being round. But then again, there's some counter evidence, which I'm going to talk about here. The big deal is this. You know that for most of us in the Northern Hemisphere, we have some listeners in Australia as well, and New Zealand, but the folks that are in the Northern Hemisphere, we all look up and we see Polaris, the North Star, and it wobbles a little bit over the course of an evening, but it's pretty much in the same place, and the stars go around it. You know, you see those bulb exposures where there's a perfect circle up there. The other interesting thing to note for those of you who don't believe in satellites is that there are things that appear to be stars, which are actually geocentric orbit satellites, which do reflect a tremendous amount of light, and they don't move. So in those circular exposures of stars traveling an 8-hour period at night, there are little gems up there that don't move. And those are, you know, supposedly our spy satellites, our GPS satellites, all that kind of stuff. Now, I've said on the show that every time I lose cell phone signal, I lose GPS along with it. So there's definitely a theory out there that GPS, as it existed prior to satellites littering the world, the military was using GPS through transmission towers and triangulation. If you play games like Pokemon Go, they have an option to use your, I guess, cell phone tower proximity without GPS, and they have an option to turn GPS on. Actually, sorry, it's not Pokemon Go. It's actually your map technology. I forgot what map app it is, but you turn on GPS and you get, you know, down to a few feet of where you are versus in direction and that kind of stuff. If you turn it off and they try to use triangulation, it's much bigger box of where you are, right? It's not so accurate. So I don't know why I lose GPS when I go to concerts out in the desert. And it's just bizarre. The second we can't make a phone call is the second the GPS fails and we can't use it. It's really odd. Now, I don't know if that's improved. I have a car now that does GPS, so next time I take my car out there, I'll be able to see how my car behaves for GPS as well. But the GPS is supposed to be a grid of satellites in space that essentially beam down their identity. And there's nothing from your phone going up to a GPS satellite. It's your phone triangulating the names of the satellites that are talking to your phone. And so your phone is triangulating where it is according to the strength of the signal it gets from a GPS satellite. And there's no storm or anything that's going to actually interfere with that. I guess maybe a super duper electrical storm might do it. But, you know, California, we don't have any of that stuff. But the stars in the Southern Hemisphere are the most telling in terms of countering the flat earth disk theory, which is that folks that would be on the opposite side of the disk would not see the same stars because they'd be looking at the edge of a firmament that's rotating. And so on a round ball, you know, if you take the extreme left, just take a disk and you go extreme west point, extreme east point, they should be seeing different stars. But on the heliocentric ball that we're actually living on, they're really close, and so they look out at the sky and they see the same exact stars in the sky, and they should. So the fact that that is the case, at the end of, you know, folks on the tip of South America will see generally the same stars that are being seen in Australia. They're so far apart that there would be a big differential in their placement. The other one is that if the Antarctica was a big disk, a border around our disk, that the idea that when we're in the, when they're in summer, when the Earth is tilted away from the sun and it has more light being exposed to it, that those long six-month winters and six-month summers would not occur because the sun would be going around a disk and it would always be daylight sunlight within a 24-hour period on really the majority of the outer disk would be in one exposure or the other because it's, you know, sun's only going to touch a part of it or be gone for most of its journey around this large disk, right? Now, the circumference of the actual disk is argued a little bit between 16 and 18,000 miles. And I think that has to do with the fact that if you're on the inside of the disk, it's slightly smaller circumference than the actual outer firmament theory disk, which would be even bigger. But I want to say early on in the episode that I want the Flat Earth people to keep going. Keep going, keep chopping it down, and keep trying to find things. Like, there are folks that have taken the videos of daylight sunlight of Antarctica, and they've watched supposedly the 24-hour time lapse of the sun going in its path at the South Pole. And I've watched these videos too about a year ago where the shadows on the poles, like flag poles that are in the ground, and the shadows on the structures never quite complete a 360, that they go halfway around and then they flip and it goes back to the first point and goes halfway around back to the first point. So it's as if someone is tampering with the time-lapse photography to make it look like they do have sustained daylight and sustained darkness, as Russia and Alaska do on the northern side of the ball, right? Or of the disc, excuse me. The other thing that I'm waiting to have happen is, you know, there were going to be a lot of laser experiments to prove that that it was either a ball or a disc by scientists that are sort of taking a really cool position of saying, we don't know either. There do seem to be properties where it looks like it's flat. It's weird, you know? And so what they were going to do, and I don't believe they've... I've had listeners say that they've done it, but I've gone to Brian Mullen's page and I haven't seen... He was the guy who was going to lead it, and I haven't seen any results. But he continues to do more presentations on a whiteboard that talk about things that were very confusing to me, and I haven't really resolved it myself. I don't know why there aren't, you know, physicists that use particle system simulations to prove one way or the other how the atmosphere would behave in a three-dimensional way. You know, like, there's supposedly at the equator we're traveling 1,000 miles an hour, and as you go up to the North Pole you hit zero. So just for the proportion up to the percentage between equator and North Pole, you just multiply that percentage times 100 miles or 1,000 miles an hour, and that's how fast you're going wherever you are on the Earth, right? But there's a lot of questions about how could we be spinning at 1,000 miles an hour at the equator and not feel it. One of the arguments, which seems a little silly, against is to say, well, if you look at the fact that the Earth only rotates once a day, 1,000 miles an hour isn't really spinning that fast. So it's not like it's a top spinning so fast that we'd be thrown off the surface of the Earth. And there's a good point there. But at the same time, if you were to take a helicopter and take off the ground and hold position, you would be initially spun at 1,000 miles an hour because you're part of the Earth and its rotational forces. And then as you stay there, you would become more and more disconnected with the Earth, and you would start taking on either a stationary, your velocity might slow down, or you would at least take the velocity of the atmosphere, which is moving at different speeds as you keep going up and up and up, right? You know, the jet stream is said to be moving, but in reality, I think what they're trying to say is that it's actually more stationary the more you go up, and that because the Earth is spinning underneath it, it seems like it's moving very quickly. Again, I haven't had the opportunity to talk to any scientists who are specialists in this area to affirm this or deny this, and I haven't found a video created by someone with those skill sets and that background to confirm or deny it either, right? But there seems to be an argument there. And that's where Brian Mullen's last video I saw him do did that. So we don't have these laser experiments. There was also the notion that one of the biggest reasons we're told in grade school of why we know the world is round is that ships' masses go down last. The hull of the ship goes down first when it hits the edge, the apex of the curve that we are able to see. And that it goes down, and then you can see the mast go down second. And then eventually the ship disappears off the coast. Now, what's really fascinating about that particular experiment that's taught to us as kids, and it's always Christopher Columbus that's always told this, and that's supposedly how he thought, you know, this rounder theory is true, and I'm going to go ahead and sail out on the Atlantic, and we'll find out what's on the other side. I think I'll get to India. And, of course, he landed in North America. But with the stuff that we've seen online with telescopes, it would seem that the human eye doesn't see that far even on a really good day, we don't see that far out over the ocean with our little human eyeballs to see this phenomenon occur. We just see it disappear due to the atmosphere density. So, but when we do, so the debunkers have come back and said, look, if you look at the footage that is submitted as the fact that if you keep zooming out in the ocean, you still see the full hull and the full ship, it's because those that footage has been taken at the very apex of where it starts to vanish on the other side of the apex of the curve, and therefore they're sort of cheating, right? Well, again, when you're on the planet Earth, it's, well, again, when you're on Earth as a human being, even if you're 10 feet tall, divide 10 by 8,000, and that's the percentage off the surface of the Earth your eyeballs can get, unless you're up on Mount Everest looking around, which then you'd be under a bed of, you'd be above a bed of clouds. It would largely prohibit any curvature, but you're not going to see any curve. And you're not going to see any curve being 5 miles up or 6 miles up. You just won't. It's not high enough, right? And I think most flat earthers are willing to concede that. So when you take a photograph out of your plane and you see flat horizon, you're not seeing any curvature for a very scientific reason, and not because it's flat. So when we're looking out over the ocean as human beings, you're not seeing any curvature, and seeing the curvature, you're not seeing curvature on the edges for very specific reasons that are not going to negate a round ball Earth. But there, you also would have the same phenomenon and limitation looking out straight, right? Because your eyes can see a diameter, a circular diameter, radius, I should say, around your position. And so for the same reason you have curves on the right or left, you're not going to see a lot of curves straight ahead. So what these debunkers have done is take more telescopic imagery of ships disappearing off the coast, and they said you have to look further out, and eventually you'll start seeing this phenomenon occur. Now, I live next to Long Beach, California, which is a huge shipping dock where a lot of tankers come in I believe oil. I think they're actually picking up the oil, but I'm not quite sure. But there's a lot of, but they have a lot of these merchant tankers, you know, that have products on them, you know, cars and all kinds of stuff. And they're massive ships. I mean, it is utterly phenomenal how massive these ships are. And the way that we know that they're massive from looking at it from the coast is they will be on the edge of the ocean out there that we can see, and they're still big. They're still super big. And we've had a couple strikes over the last 10 years where our version of longshoremen, they were unwilling to unpack the boats. And so the boats all stacked up out there on the coast, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of them. And when we saw that, there was no flat earth theory on YouTube at the time. But when you saw all these boats out there, it just, you know, there weren't that many before the whole coast was completely covered with boats, which is just really kind of interesting and phenomenal to look at. So I have to say, you know, I haven't taken a telescope out to the coast and, you know, zoomed in and zoomed in and zoomed in, but I have seen the footage on YouTube where people do that. But these folks say, look, you know, there's always a little bit of ocean above the object that they film, and they never quite take you to the point where the boat is on the very edge of the ocean, and yet it continually shrinks out of view, so you don't see that. The other one that's very interesting is the shape and size of the sun in the sky, that if it were to be moving away in a perspective, which is a flat earth model, it would continually get smaller and smaller and smaller. And what is said to be the case is that where there's a lot of humidity, if you're looking at the sun, especially next to the ocean, there's so much humidity coming off of the ocean that is magnifying the size of the sun. And then when it goes off in the desert, it does get really tiny and turns into a pin light. And there's footage all over YouTube, you know, submitted as proof that this does exist. And again, without someone having an effects degree or a firm to create this footage for them, it would appear that there are arguments just to support both sides of the fence on that, right? Now, I always see it set on the ocean. But what I don't see is I have the, and again, we're very close to the ocean no matter what, and our coastline's diagonal, so there's really no clear east-west perspective from where I'm sitting. The sun that comes up It comes up behind this camera way off in the distance. And I don't have the ability to see the horizon because I'm always in the city, right? And I have to go down to the beach to see it sink in the ocean on the other side. And then there's the humidity argument, right? But while I was in Kansas, which is very flat, and yes, it is humid in Kansas at times, I have not seen the Pinlight sun, and that's where I took all my astronomy. That's where I had my telescope as a kid. But I've also watched several times the sunset in Havasu, Lake Havasu, Nevada, or Arizona, excuse me, because I'm on the Arizona side at the time. But I will tell you that I've got photographs of the sun setting many times in Havasu, and it's not a pin light. And sure, I'm on a lake, and it could be contributing a little bit, but I doubt that if I got out of the lake and walked, you know, 100 feet over the ridge that we film it on, that somehow as I walk past the lake, that the sun's going to start shrinking and shrinking and shrinking with every step, because that's sort of the theory. So the perspective on the sun's size is hard for me to swallow, right? Because I haven't seen that pin light thing myself. Now, as I said in the moon episode, what is really weird, and it doesn't have to negate anything to do with flat or heliocentric, is it does seem really, really bizarre, okay, that the moon seems to always, when a solar eclipse occurs, that even though the moon is between, I think, 234 to 239, hundreds of thousands of miles away, that it doesn't seem to ever go in front of the sun and have most of the sun going around the moon. I have never seen a photograph of that online. I've never seen, the couple times I've seen solar eclipses, I've never seen it fail, that the moon completely blocks the sun. And I think I saw at least a couple in the Bay Area. I saw one really amazing one when I was a kid, about 9 years old, 10 years old in Kansas, where it was just perfect. Right out the balcony of my apartment that I was in. In fact, you could even sit on the floor inside my apartment, the very first one I ever saw, and I saw the solar eclipse. And the funny thing was that my mom had gone jogging. She did this kind of 6 mile jog in the evening hours, and she was out running when it happened, and she was unaware it was going to happen. I'm not sure I was aware, but the neighbors started talking about it and started getting ready to look at it. And so I came out on the balcony. It's probably 1979, I'm looking up there, and somewhere in that range. And sure enough, man, full eclipse. And I mean, it was dark for a really short period of time. And my mom was jogging and was worried that I would be freaked out at home. And I'm just orgasming looking at this thing. It was amazing. So the few I've seen, just so you know, unless it was designated as a partial eclipse, the fulls that I've seen have been 100% full. So that coinkadink that we have an elliptical orbit moon. The moon's way too big for our planet. It seems to be made out of stuff that's completely different than our planet is made out of, and that it's perfectly situated in space to block the sun. Seems like someone's doing something on purpose, right? It is funny that in the Truman Show, it's basically a flat Earth, right? So he has a very small city that he's in, surrounded by water, which is the barrier, and then he's got a firmament dome around him, and the moon is the center for Ed Harris's character to produce the show. That's very interesting, you know. And of course, people like Jernism really chalk that up to the fact it's Hollywood insiders that know it's a flat Earth and that they're just toying with you. Now, on the subject of Hollywood in support of the flat Earth, either the joke or the real theory or whatever, it is phenomenal when you watch the Jernism videos. He's done this amazing job compiling occurrences of flat Earth imagery, sort of the UN logo, all over Hollywood productions. I mean, it is unbelievable. From chalkboards that say, I forgot exactly what it was. It was like something like Astronomy 101 or Geology 101 or something like that was on a chalkboard. It was a flat Earth logo, to weird sitcoms with flat Earth models painted on the wall. And they weren't even complete. You know, it was like the edges were chopped off because the wall wasn't big enough to hold it. But Back to the Future has the doc has a one in his garage. You know, so there is, you know, I mean, you, I don't know if these are just props. The one in the garage appeared in, I believe, in a couple other films. Because what happens is prop houses in L.A. have goofy, weird things. And if someone tasks you with, let's say you're even fresh, you're new, and you got this crazy opportunity to do part of production design, and they say, okay, we've got this laboratory, go to the prop house and find everything that looks scientific. You might just grab this clock that has a round earth background to it. I think it's a clock. But you might just grab it because it's sort of global and it looks scientific and you don't even know what it is, right? You might grab a barometer and a Jacob's ladder and a bunch of other weird stuff, and you're not trying to tell a narrative about how the world works. It's just this prop that keeps getting reused over and over and over again, right? There's a funny caveat that's similar to this, which is in my hometown of Chanute, Kansas, there's a book called So I Married an Adventurer, written by Osa and Mark. It's written by Osa. Is that right? Osa Johnson. It's about her and her husband, Osa and Martin Johnson, who used to travel in. They were the first Americans to really photograph Africa and tribes and all kinds of stuff. Well, they have this book that they created that's famous now that has a sort of a tiger skin cover on it. And maybe I'll throw it up in the thing here. But interior designers for decades have put the Osa Martin Johnson book in all of their photography. It's all over the place. It's crazy. It's almost like a Where's Waldo thing. Now, it sort of died off a little bit as of recent, but I can tell you in the 90s, for sure, it was all over the place, and then probably the first part of this century. I own four copies of it here because I'm from the town, and we collect them. I walked into a Anthropology one time, and they had one inside the case. In fact, they had two or three inside the case. And I asked them, I said, you mind if I buy one of those? They're like, yeah, sure. They sold to me for nothing, not realizing that the book cost about $120 if it's in pristine condition. They sold to me for $15. Woohoo. So maybe Hollywood's trying to tell us something. Maybe it's just a coinkadink. Maybe it just looks scientific. Maybe it's a joke, right? But like I mentioned in my Electrical Universe episode, which again may or may not air before this one, expanding Earth is the number one theory for me that is just utterly conclusive and is as inaccurate or inaccurate as Google Earth is in proportions to the Peter projection map version of the Earth. Their imagery derived from NASA photographs of the bottom of the ocean. You can literally see the two seams down the and even the contour of the stretching of the continents out of the ocean floor, right? These aren't moving. It's just that there's a tear in the center of the Earth, and the Earth expands for various reasons I will cover in Electrical Universe, if you're interested in that theory. And you can see it. You can see the contour of the tear down the Pacific and the contour of the tear down the Atlantic, and it matches the shape of the continents on left and right. You can bring them all together on all sides, removing the oceans, and the Earth is about a fourth the size, which would be coincidentally where dinosaurs are rumored to have existed, which would reduce the world's gravity down to a fourth of its current gravity, allowing gigantic creatures to exist, allowing Earth's atmosphere to be extremely thick, facilitating, you know, insects being 3 feet wide. You know, insects don't have lungs, right? They have these platters, these patties inside their chest, and they have perforations down their ectoskeleton that allow oxygen particles in that they metabolize into their life force. And so when the oxygen gets thinner due to perhaps more gravity, more diameter to Earth, the insects get small again because they can't metabolize oxygen to continue growing. There was a lot of theories that with the super duper thick oxygen that things lived a lot longer too, because radiation exposure is less, and because the vegetation on Earth is plentiful. Plus, again, you know, the life expectancy without toxins and migrating around the world and ingesting too much sugar as a trend of, you know, sophistication, we just have better health, right? There's the paleontology diets where you eat like a caveman and you can you'll slim down really, really fast, and you'll be very, very healthy. But you have to obviously ingest the most pure raw materials and not anything GMO or synthetic, right? But I want to talk about something metaphysical about the flat earth thing that I don't really hear people talking about, and it may not be important, but it may play, if you understand what I'm about to say, which you will, but if you take it to heart, it might help the consumption of data off the internet in general in these areas, right? Flat earth theory is, for a lot of us, just very interesting. You know, it's sort of, it's an exciting subject to debate in a world that is pretty boring online, right? The internet is boring. The internet as a whole reminds a lot of people that they're by themselves. I don't care if you have a family of 10, if you work with 50 people, you're in charge of a big empire of some sort. In the end, you know, if you're crawling into your phone to communicate with most people, you're by yourself. And so what that does is that creates a void that needs to be filled with something, right? I mentioned a long time ago in season one, if you ever played the game The Sims by Will Wright, we bought his company at Electronic Arts a long time ago. Sims had a social meter on it, and this is before social media blew up. And if your character didn't socialize with other characters, they got to a point where they wouldn't do anything. In fact, they'd lie down on the floor and just sort of whine and cry. And they wouldn't go to the bathroom. They'd even pee there right where they were, I believe. And, you know, when you're struck with something metaphysical being put into a progress bar in a video game, and you start to see this kind of irrational behavior, it's hard for you to wrap your mind around, wow, I never even thought about this. And this guy thought about it so much that he made it a bar in a video game, and it's this most debilitating thing on planet Earth. And the way the bar worked was that if you were down on your social interaction, the bar was red and full. If you had your interaction, it would turn red or turn green and be full. And so it became a joke between friends of mine that we'd say, oh, you know, I got to come see you. My social bar's on red. And everyone understood. It was actually a really cool little utility for communication. But why do we like shows like Coast to Coast AM? Where there's just, you know, crazy stuff on there constantly. Why do we like these theories like flat earth, no forest on flat earth, the space stations being fake, the satellites being fake, moon missions being faked, all this kind of stuff. Some having some truth to it, some of it may or may not be true. But why are we so fascinated with this kind of stuff? I will tell you that in choosing topics for this show, which is becoming ever increasingly difficult, the idea of creating season 3 and making 100 episodes is almost unfathomable. Is that you can only, there's only so many subjects to really talk about, you know, unless I turn this into, well, even if I did turn into sort of the more cerebral emotions of man and go through them all, there probably aren't 100 separate subjects I could talk about, but it would get boring. We need things that are exciting and mysterious, and they're frontiers. You know, I talk about dreams on the show every once in a while, and I think that's a frontier of consciousness. I really, really do. We all have minimized and poo-pooed what dreams are. We don't think they really play a role in our lives. Now, some of you get into Freudian study of dreams. I've never found there to be any consistency at all with dreams and predicting anything in your life or anything like that. Sure, you can. I'll be doing design, hardware, software design, or I'll be playing a video game, and my God, my dreams are 2/3 that the algorithms are involved with that, which I hate. But the flat earth thing comes around, and the people that put it together and the people that really put forth the notion that it's flat, you know, they've done a brilliant job of really calling into question how we think about things that we have had certified to us and that aren't to be questioned. And I think what I always told my buddies at the Smoke Lounge was, regardless of what shape it is, the most beautiful thing is that it, one, is exposed what I believe a lot of fraud of the space institutions that are out there, but it gets human beings to start thinking. And so there's sort of a cautionary tale with things like flat earth theories. And again, I'm not trying to say that flat earthers are wrong, because I who am I to say, right? I don't know. I haven't been to space. I think that for me, again, expanding Earth and looking at the surface of the oceans is conclusive, and that only works in a ball. But then again, Neil deGrasse Tyson comes out and say it's like a pear-shaped Earth. I mean, like, what? Right? A pear-shaped Earth makes no sense in a zero-gravity, relatively zero-gravity spin object in space. It would be a perfect sphere no matter what. If anything, it would be oblate from the center equator and nothing else, right? But there is definitely, I think, let's just say you're approaching a brand new thing. There's some brand new theory out there. The latest one I heard was from a comment from a listener, which I absolutely laughed out loud, which is, have you heard the theory that North Korea doesn't exist? Given that there are a lot of people that have gone there on video and literally videotaped everything. I have friends of mine who've worked in Korea before it was destabilized and after it's destabilized, and the DMZ, they've seen all this stuff. They moved around. I thought that was kind of funny. This stuff is alluring. And the process of letting your mind go into this sort of, wow, maybe reality isn't what I thought it was in this particular area. I think that that is a super duper healthy frame of mind and a super duper healthy exercise for all human beings. And so it's sort of like my take on Christianity. Me personally, I don't believe Jesus Christ ever existed, and I believe that we have a million different ways to assert that belief. However, the metaphor within the story of Christ, which is borrowed from lots of other religions, of course, if you study Egyptology, you'll notice real quickly that a lot of his sermons were based on hieroglyphs that are pounded in stone thousands of years before his rumored existence, right? That were pitched as nothing more than metaphorical stories from the Egyptians to their people. But there is value if you don't know anything else, right? You're this born, you're born fresh into the world. There are no systems of belief. If you get rid of a lot of the rituals related to Christianity and you just go with the how to be nice to each other, and you go back to Old Testament, you bring out Moses' Ten Commandments, and you start looking about how to be nice to each other and how to behave in society and what's a sin and what's not a sin, I would say the majority of everything that they say holds up today, right? And I know that a lot of you have done research in other tomes of religion, and there's hideous commandments out there that say that, you know, they subdivide what it's like to molest a child with different rules to molest a boy versus molest a girl. I mean, there are tomes out there that various religions have engaged over time to get what they wanted, right? Perverts essentially writing the codec of how to behave, and they just embed their bad behavior into the behavior of man, and they certify themselves in the name of God so they can molest in the name of God. Oddly, it still exists to this day, right? But flat earth theories like that have a value because they get us to open up our minds, look, you know, perpendicular to the you know, the vector that we're observing reality at this point. And I just think it's awesome. I just think it's very, very healthy. And, you know, I won't lie, if someone were to submit proof that it's flat, I think I would probably look at that evidence and feel super excited about the mysteries that proof would immediately spawn in my mind. Oh my gosh, it really is flat, you know? You somehow, and they'd have to counteract the theories of expanding Earth. They would have to counter basically every argument for the stars seeming to be at the, you know, at the same location at the southern hemisphere as they are with the northern hemisphere. So it would be interesting. It's a tall order, man. It's a real tall order to completely prove that the world is flat, you know? At the same time, I want you to understand the difference between potential entertainment that you adopt out of the internet and just and facts. You know, I think most of us have come to the conclusion that we're not so quick to say this is fact. I don't think we're that quick anymore like we used to be before the internet. Boy, so you get told something, you just believe it. And I think I mentioned this a really long time ago, but I'll say it again. There are things that I have repeated, and I can't think of anything off the top of my head, I apologize, but there are things I repeated my entire life because I was told it was true by some elder around me, or I heard people I thought were credible saying something, and I repeated it. And then in the last, I would say there's been an accelerated pattern in myself in the last 2 years, especially doing this show. When I think about everything that I say, and I say this into a microphone, and then I take it into an editing room and I edit it, and I listen to myself again, and sometimes I cut entire phrases out because I think, well, that might be true, but I really don't have any credible references to it, so I'll just cut a whole section out. It doesn't happen very often, but it does happen. You know, as the very next trend comes up, because there will be another trend on YouTube that's like a flat earth, where it's questioning reality. And, you know, I proposed in the episode, does space exist? Has anybody dreamed of space? And we got a couple guys that came in and said they did, and they were mostly in fictional sort of Star Trek environments. I have my own dreams that are not really space, but they feel kind of like space. One of my buddies said he had an astral projection dream where he was kind of flying through space very quickly. But no one's really had this lucid dream of being in space, moving around, going to planet, that sort of thing that I've had reported back, right? And again, I have a lot of friends of mine that work in visual effects that have dealt with space scenes for over 20 years. They've got Emmy stacked up at home for having created the best space scenes on planet Earth. And when asked if they ever dreamed of space, they hadn't dreamed of space. They never took their work home into their mind. But geez, I play a video game like Fallout 4, and I'm dreaming Fallout 4, post-apocalyptic world. Bizarre, right? Because the image system has been given to me in a fictitious setting inside of a video game. And so I merely took that fiction and put it inside my fictional dream, you know? So I think one of the most valuable intellectual things we can take away from things like Flat Earth and things that are very similar to those sort of outrageous refinements in what we believe is to say, you know, like if you bump into a new one, let's just say that, you're probably going to be by yourself unless you're in a group of people like a smoke lounge or a living room or something, and you go, well, you know, because I think when Flat Earth comes out, and if you were to watch a bunch of videos on Flat Earth without having this process in place, you might immediately call every friend in the world and say, did you know the Earth was flat? You know, do you know it's really flat and it's not round, and you're jumping on board really, really quickly, and you're sort of potentially damaging the opinion of others of your ability to siphon and filter information, right? Because your friends will think, my God, this guy believes everything, right? So I think that we need to put a bit of a regulator in there and maybe some steps where we say to ourselves, look, this is one of those things. This is one of those sort of flat earth things. The Mandela effect, another great example of a theory that came on board. You know, I myself think the Mandela effect could be very organic. I've done two episodes on it. You can go watch those. You know, I think the two that really stick with me the most, because it's really the two that I'm aware of personally, is James Earl Jones not knowing what he said in Star Wars, Empire Strikes Back, whether it's Luke, I'm your father, or no, I'm your father. You know, he was interviewed for 20 years after he did the scene, and he's quoted many, many times as saying, you know, Luke, I'm your father. And Anne Rice not knowing the name of her book, Interview with a Vampire versus Interview with the Vampire. And there's an hour-long compilation of everyone who worked on the book and the movie, her agent, her, all saying Interview with a Vampire over and over and over again when it's now Interview with the Vampire. So, odd. But there could be reasons why at least her piece is, because I guess they changed the name of the book in Europe or something, even in the other timeline. But just put a little bit of hesitation in there for adoption. Like, try to be a bit of a hard ass when it comes to changing your mind about things, but definitely open your mind and let it in and take a look at it. You know, this show is always about opening your mind and thinking thoughts that you've never thought before to see where you end up at the end of the game. But it's very similar to the piece of advice where someone tells you never do anything in a state of mind that is anger, because you don't have your faculties, right? There are plenty of, I was watching a series on Netflix, which I usually don't watch these type of shows, but it's called Lockdown. And it's a prison documentary series. There's been several like it over the years. And you know, for me, it's a sociological experiment to look at these interviews with these inmates and see kind of what got them into these worlds. And most of them will admit, you know, they committed crimes in the heat of passion, where they were very angry, either an individual or angry at life, or they took drugs that changed their state of mind and got them to do things to loved ones, to children, all these horrible situations. And so we can look at those people and say, ah, yes, I don't do that. You know, I try to count to 10 or I walk away or whatever. You know, everyone has acted out in a fit of anger. Everyone's done it, right? I think we can learn from that little lesson in life when it comes to ingesting things on the internet as fact. Have fun with it. Be entertained. Let your mind wander. But at the end of the day, you know, there's a maybe pile in your brain. There really is. There's true, there's false, and there's maybe. And there's no sin in having your maybe pile grow bigger than your true and false pile. In fact, I don't see how it couldn't be bigger in today's reality. But just hang on to things. And also be aware of where you get your information from. And so if you're, you know, for me personally, there are only two locations on planet Earth that you first ingest flat Earth, and that's YouTube and maybe a website or two to read about further experiments. And then you start talking to your pilot friends and your friend friends, and you just try to find if anyone's ever seen certain things. And you make your assessment at the end. Oh, the other Mandela effect was Eli Whitney being a white guy. I still have plenty of friends. When I found out the Eli Whitney thing, that whole day I called people up on the telephone and said, you know, what do you know about Eli Whitney? And they said, well, the only thing I remember, he's a black guy. Yeah, he's a white guy. Right? Really weird. When I thought about people not dreaming of space, I called a few friends of mine right away and sent emails and text messages and all came back, no, I've never dreamed of space. Well, that's weird. Right? So, you know, it could be that space exists, but there's a reason why we don't dream of it. Maybe what we learned about dreaming is that the reason why I don't dream of Paris, France, is that I haven't been there as an adult where I could remember it. I was there as a baby. I can't remember it. I can't remember where I was born. Really? Right? And so maybe we simply can't dream of things we've never perceived of. Just as simple as that. You've never been in space. Well, you can't dream about space. You've never been there. Now, it's weird for special effects guys because they do live in space on their television screens and they watch dailies all day long. And they go to movies all the time and it would seem a little strange. But then again, I haven't talked to every single special effects group. You know, my buddy went back to his group and interviewed 15 people who have been in the industry for anywhere from 20 to 30 years, and everyone came back zero. Really odd. So I think you feel me on this. I won't belabor the issue. We don't need a 2-hour episode on this whole thing. Because of flat Earth, because of expanding Earth, my mind is still very much heliocentric, although my faith in space programs to help children believe it is still at near zero, which frustrates me greatly. There's still a few tales of people that I don't know if it's true or false, but you have, there's two flat Earth stories that I thought were very fascinating, and it would be so easy to manufacture them, put them online, backdate them or whatever. But there was the woman that believed that the world was flat. She went and got herself into some expedition in the South Pole. Supposedly the story is, and this is even on Wikipedia, which is funny. I think both these people on Wikipedia, I forgot her name, but you can look up, you know, probably flat Earth, snowmobile, woman, South Pole, and you'll probably find it. But she supposedly took a snowmobile, went to the edge of the Earth, found that there was a whole place there, took pictures of it, drove her, you know, vehicle back up to the known areas, put the camera on the snowmobile with a letter and said, I found the edge. Here are the pictures. I'm out of here. And the way the story is recorded is that the film accidentally exposed, right? I think that's pretty interesting. And the other one is a gentleman that created the very first, and again, I can't remember his name. It's these, anytime a name is foreign, it's really hard for me to remember the last name and first name. But he had created the very first high weather balloon vehicle. So he created a kind of a chrome vehicle. He painted one half of it as a ball. He painted one half of it black. He put these prop propellers on outside of it so he could hopefully control its orientation when it went up there. What he wanted to do was have the reflective side go towards the sun to get rid of most of the heat coming in. So just because he didn't want to boil inside this thing, and he wanted the dark side to go towards the darker side to absorb cold to keep it nice and together. But the way that they described it, I can't remember how high they said he went. I think it was in the 70-mile range or something, which again would be very close to the surface of the Earth. And he pressurized it, went up into space and up in the sky, and his observations, his written observations, this was like the early 30s, I think, but his written observations were that the world was a disc and it had upturned edges. And that's recorded in his history of having done that and having said that. So I don't know if that had to do with the way his windows were shaped. I don't know, that people don't touch those two very much. And so these are sort of more coast-to-coast kind of stories. So I thought that's kind of fun. But anyway, I think you feel me. If you dig the series, please subscribe. If you like the episode, please like. Again, it's a variety show. Subjects change. If you don't like one, just don't watch it. It's cool. No offense. So take care of yourself and someone else, and I will see you in the next Deep Thoughts. Over and out.